Well, I enjoyed talking with Sean Pesch, not just because he's one of the best money managers in the world, and that's official. I'll tell you why in a moment. But because he does the most interesting things, and including most recently, is meeting a guy called Howard Marks. Now, those of you who've been following BizNews for a while will know that Sean told me about this book some time ago. Ooh, I don't know how well you can see it. It seems to be a little bit. Anyway, there's the big. It's called The Most Important Thing. It's written by Howard Marks. Sean said, you got to read this book. It's a classic. Well, it taught us all about, taught me all about second-level thinking or the concept of second-level thinking, and that's something that Sean applies. Before we go into your meeting, finally, with Howard Marks, it's like I was talking to Byron Shepherd this week. He does a podcast here called Morning Shot, and he was asking about the best people that I've interviewed and most interesting and so on. And I said, well, the one that's got away is Warren Buffett. So I've never interviewed Buffett, and I'm almost certain I never will. And you getting to meet with Howard Marks is a little bit like maybe me cracking an invitation to interview Buffett. Al Sean, it's extraordinary. How did you set it all up?
Well, Alec, you know, I have to thank you and BizNews and LinkedIn. And let me tell you what happened. So you'll recall at BizNews IC, okay, in March, I spoke about cycles. And I referenced Howard Marks quite a bit. I'd read his book, The Art of Mastering Cycles and Getting Your Odds on the Side. And then I posted that on LinkedIn. And I got contacted by Richard, who's Oaktree's MD over here in the UK. And I didn't know Richard, and he just got in touch and he said, "This is Sean, I see you quote Howard Marks quite a bit. You're obviously a fan. He's over here at the end of May, and we're going to see some clients, and we're having a group lunch. Would you like to come along?" So, you know, so I said, "Absolutely, that's so kind of you." And so it was because I'd had the opportunity of BizNews to actually talk about him. And then LinkedIn, which is such a positive format, a forum, you know, that's what I like about LinkedIn. Everybody's doing good stuff and we're all in this together. You know, I had the opportunity to meet him. So that was last Thursday. And I have to say it was such a positive experience. And he surprised on the upside. He's a lovely man. You know, just to touch on that, you know, he's the co-chairman of Oaktree. And Oaktree managed some $203 billion in assets, mostly credit, 80% credit, a small bit of equity, which is mainly private equity, and then some real estate with a fantastic track record. I mean, that's how they've managed to amass $200 billion. It was bought, 62% was bought by Brookfield Asset Management in 2019 for nearly $5 billion. So, you know, here you've got a very wealthy person who doesn't earn a salary, doesn't take a bonus, obviously has got some equity in the business, but loves talking to people and teaching and all of that. And so he's just such a lovely guy. And just to give you an idea, you know, we had a finger lunch in one room and there were about 12 of us. Okay. So a finger lunch in one room and then the presentation was in the next room. And he came in at the end of the finger lunch, went around, introduced himself to everybody, you know, shook my hand and said, "I'm Howard." And then we went through to the main presentation. But a quick little story. I said, "Howard, it's such a pleasure to meet you. And I've actually brought you a gift for you and Richard for inviting me. And it's some South African wine. I don't know whether you drink wine, but it's from the Cape of Good Hope. And I thought we could all do with some Good Hope." I thought it's a bit cheesy when I say it now. It was probably very cheesy at the time. He said, "I've never been to South Africa." And I said, but Howard, you're famous there. Okay, in part thanks to you, Alec. I said, "You're famous there." I said, it reminds me of Rodriguez. Remember that singer Rodriguez? And they had that movie Sugar Man. He says, "I know the movie." I said, "Well, the only difference is you're actually famous everywhere else. And Sugar Man was only famous in South Africa." He didn't know it. So anyway, you know, that's how our conversation started. And then we went through and he had a whiteboard and it was a bit of Q&A. There was a bit of an intro. And I thought maybe I could just tell you some of the key takeaways that I got from that, you know?
What a pleasure. I'm looking forward to it, Sean, and you do this so well. It's almost like you do a presentation for us. But if you were to rank it on the highlights of your professional career, where would meeting Howard Marks and spending time with him rank?
I mean, you know, it's right up there. You know, I remember when I first met the late Alan Gray, and William Gray was invited to lunch, and at the time that was just massive. And this stacks up, that stacks up with that. You know, when you get, I've never been to Omaha, and you know, just things just haven't panned out. I was considering going this year, but I had a last year actually presentation in South Africa that I couldn't get out of, and so this was just amazing. And you know, remember, this is the guy that Warren Buffett reads. Warren Buffett has said publicly, when there's a memo from Howard Marks in my inbox, that's what I read first. You know, so, and he's obviously met, he referred to a lunch that he'd once had with Charlie Munger. It sounded like they spoke regularly, you know, and he's a remarkable, you know, 70, I think he's 78, but he is so sharp. And boy, I hope I'm going to be like that at 78 if I get there. So, yeah, no, it was amazing. But he just does it because he's passionate about the industry, about, you know, thinking. He's such a good thinker. And in some of the things, you know, even I asked him a question, which I'll tell you about in a second, but you know, boom, straight to the second level thinking. Yeah, you know, it's just instinctive for him. So yeah, no, a real pleasure. I'm very fortunate.
It's an interesting point that about thinking. Recently, I've been doing quite a lot of work on understanding how Elon Musk has been such an incredible entrepreneur, reshaping three industries, but not what he's done, but how he thinks. And he thinks differently to most people. He breaks it all down to what he calls first principles. What you taught me from the book of Howard Marks is to look at second level. Now, if you can apply first principles in the business that you're doing, in other words, what is it that you're actually trying to achieve in this business overall? What is it that you're wanting to do? And then you apply Howard Marks's second level thinking. My goodness, what a winning combination.
Look, that's right. And you know, we're so lucky these days because, yeah, you speak to people and they go, I wish I'd had a mentor when I was younger. And you go, well, we've got mentors. We've got guys like this that do podcasts. You know, every single one of Howard Marks's memos is on a podcast. You can go and have a look. Memo by Howard Marks. You go listen to them. And obviously, ahead of this meeting, I was re-listening to all of them. I mean, I'd read many of the memos. I hadn't actually listened to the, you know, sound in his head. So we're so lucky because we've got YouTube, we've got these books, we've got the podcast, we've got, you know, it's all accessible to us at very low cost. It's quite incredible, really.
It is indeed. Okay, so you have a finger lunch. Hopefully you washed your hands before you shook his, and off you went into the presentation. So take us through it.
Yeah, so he started off talking about setting up Oak Tree back in 1995 with his partners, one of whom he refers to quite a lot is Bruce Karsh, and they are, you know, co-chair. And go and have a look at Oak Tree's website because they outline their philosophy and their business principles. And he says, we haven't changed a word since 1995. And the first thing on the first point on their philosophy, and I'll just read it. I'm not going to go through all of them. I'll just read this one. It said, risk. Our goal is not superior investment performance, but superior performance with less than commensurate risk. Above average gains in good times are not necessarily proof of a manager's skill. It takes superior performance in bad times to prove that those good time gains were earned through skill, not simply the acceptance of above average risk. And I think that's just brilliant. You know, he made the point in the conversation. He said, look, in good times, it doesn't matter if you underperform in good times because everybody's outperforming. I mean, everybody's doing well. You're all going up in absolute, you know, absolute terms. A rising tide lifts all boats. The key is how do you do in tough times? Okay. Because if it's two steps forward, one step back, you know, then that's fine. But if it's two steps forward, three steps back, you got a problem. You know, think about rugby. You make a few and then you consolidate and then you try and make a few more meters. So that was the one. I mean, there's some others, but there's six. Okay. Emphasis on consistency, the importance of market inefficiency, the benefits of specialization. Macro forecasting is not critical to investing. Now that's something that's close to my heart. You know, I mean, Simon used to say, you know, the future is just unforecastable. I mean, in such simple terms. You know,
Simon Marais, that is.
Simon Marais, yeah. And in, you know, so these incredibly smart people have an amazing way of just putting these complex ideas into simple terms. But it's fundamental to Oaktree. And he has a great analogy because he talks about this. He says, imagine you had perfect foresight. In 2019, you knew that the pandemic was going to happen the next year. And in 2021, you knew that Ukraine war was going to happen next year. And in 2022, you knew that Hamas was going to, and Israel were going to, you know, be on the brink of Middle East war and all that. And you sold because of those fears. You lost money. Okay. So the point he makes is, look, even if you knew what was going to happen, you don't know how the market's going to respond to what happens. Okay. So that's quite a key point. And the one thing that comes through in their philosophy is, you know, you speak to some organizations and you ask them, well, what's your philosophy? And they go, well, which fund? What do you mean, which fund? Well, we've got a growth fund over here. We've got a value fund over there. He goes, we have one philosophy throughout the organization that we just eat, sleep and drink. And he says, you got to know who you are and what you do. And he uses a great example. He says, you know, if you're standing at a bus stop, you'll probably catch a bus. But if you run between bus stops, you may never catch a bus. Okay. So if you, like, one day you're a valiant guy, next day you're a growth guy, and the next day you're a this, and you're fitting from one idea to the next, just stand at the bus stop and know which bus stop you want to stand at. What's good for you? What's true to your persona? And focus on that, you know? And
interesting mm-hmm. point there. You only have one fund at Ranmore.
Yeah.
And your right. performance, I was having a look at your performance before coming on, just to make sure you're still there. For those who don't understand, when you're in the one percentile, that means of all the funds in the world, those in the top 1% are in that one percentile. So one in 100. And you're in that level in your peer group going all the way back to 5 years and this year, year to date as well. And you've got one fund. Now, there are many competitors, and I'll call them competitors because they're also looking for the investors' money, who run a plethora of funds. And they would have not just value and growth, they would have a tech fund or an Asian mining fund or a Japanese big corporate funds. And the list is endless. What does Howard Marks do? Does his Oaktree have lots of funds or different funds, or do they only have the one like you?
No, so they do have a number of funds. Okay, so they will have an emerging market credit fund, a global credit fund, a developed market credit fund, high yield fund. So it's mainly interest. But the important point is that across all those funds, they're value investors. Okay. So you don't have one lot trying to, play a different game. It's just a different game in different subsets, a same game in different subsets of the market. That's the
thing. So you would be a value investor in emerging markets or a value investor in Europe. But what about from your perspective? Why have you only got the one fund? Now that you're getting so big, are you looking to perhaps diversify?
Definitely not. No, we've got one fund. Because, look, we're fortunate, Alec. You know, the nice thing about a global fund is that when the US is attractive, you can buy US equities, okay? And then if you think, right, Europe's more attractive, within our fund, we can move. We can sell those US shares and buy the European shares and then go and buy the Korean shares and all the rest. If we had an American fund and a European fund and a Asian fund, and as an investor said, oh, Sean likes America, you buy the US fund. And then we go, you know what? We actually think that Europe's better value. You then have to sell the US fund, incur capital gains tax, move your money across, convert it from dollars into euros, then invest via, you know, it's just like, so it's actually, we think it's better for the clients because we can move it, you know, as we see these opportunities coming. And we've got a huge universe and we see absolutely, we're not going to launch any other funds. We're going to stay focused. We don't even do segregated accounts.
What does that mean?
So what does that mean? Well, you get a lot of fund managers do segregated accounts. So you're a wealthy, let's say you're a wealthy Swiss family office and you come along and say, listen, I've got $100 million. Okay, or a pension fund or whatever. You know, I see your global equity's done well, but we want it slightly different. Can you just run a $100 million fund here separately for us on the side? Yeah. And a lot of fund managers do. And when you start off and you grow, you'll take money from anywhere pretty much. Okay. We've said, no, we're not going to do that. We want all the money in the same pot. Okay. We want all our staff in the same classes of shares that all our clients are. Is there special classes for no fees for staff and no, you know, none of that. It's like we're all in the same pot, on the same boat together. We think this is the way it makes sense, you know? So we stay focused, because otherwise I'm in fee negotiations with that family office and fee negotiations with that sovereign wealth fund and checking that agreement, and that's simple, and worrying about that prospectus and five fact sheets each month, one fund.
It feels a little bit like the way we do media, a bit purist, but it takes longer to get anywhere, but it is much more sustainable because you know exactly what it is that you believe in. You know, with us, we're a platform. We're not here to tell you what you should think. We are here to speak to people like Sean Pesh who know what they're talking about, so you can listen to them and say, I learned from him, or for whatever reason, they might not agree with you. That's what we are here to do. It seems to me that you're also somewhat purist in your investment approach.
Yeah, we are. We have, you know, we're all in the team, know exactly what we think, our approach, our process, and we just do it wherever we are in the world. And so, and then that just frees us up to just stay focused. So it's, you know, that was good to know that that's how they've built such a successful business. You know, Alec, he spent quite a bit of time talking about risk. And again, you know, interesting, debunks a lot of the stuff you learned at university. So think of the chart, you know, you've got return on the y-axis and you've got risk on the x-axis, and you've got a line that goes up, you know, so that conventional thinking, the more risk you take, the higher the return. He goes, yeah, but no. His point is along that line, there's a range of outcomes. So there's a probability curve at each point along the line, because just because you've taken more risk doesn't mean you're guaranteed a higher return. It means you might have a higher return, but you also might guarantee a far lower return if you bet on a risky company. So, you know, again, it's a second level, not just taking something at face value. It's digging a little bit deeper. So, and his point is, look, risk is the probability of losing money. Okay. Many people talk about, oh, risk is volatility, but you know, you get positive volatility and you get negative volatility. We all want positive volatility. We don't want negative volatility. So, the risk is the probability of losing money, and you can't measure it in advance. But we have to. So because of that, you have to accept it. You have to accept risk. Okay. And so focus on, and he said in one of those podcasts, you know, if you avoid the losers, the winners will take care of themselves. But you've got to be focused, you know, on avoiding those losers. And he goes, your market's unpredictable. And so then how do you deal with that unpredictability? Well, you manage risk by a combination of debt and equity. That's how you manage risk. Okay. And he said, if you look at the many of the broker strategists, they suggest that the outcome of the next 10 years from the S&P 500 is going to be 2-3% a year. And he, you know, he's a fixed income guy, but he doesn't wildly disagree with that. He says, when people tell him, I thought this is a good point. He goes, when people tell him, no, but the S&P, you know, does 10% a year on average. He goes, yes, but not from 20 times earnings. Well, our starting point's 20 times earnings. So yes, S&P does 10% a year on average, but not from here. Okay. And so
very important.
Starting point.
Exactly what Buffett says as well. He says is that that a lot of the marketing, clearly, if you're trying to market a particular fund, you're going to pick your starting point very carefully. Whereas if you are looking to make the maximum return from it, you should be looking through the whole cycle rather than a point that would make the returns look better than they truly are.
That's right. And which is, you know, what's interesting is he says, if you look at their oak trees, fixed income, they have, you know, European fund, SICAV, that people can invest in. It's got 500 investments and it yields 8%. You know, it's quite incredible. So you look at this, you've got a hugely diversified credit fund that's yielding 8% versus 2-3%. And he goes, you know, he thinks debt is relatively attractive here. So I thought that was a good point to share. I actually asked him a question. Because after he's spoken about risk, when there were a lot of people asking questions, I said, how do you reconcile this common thinking that we must have high conviction with the fact that the future is just uncertain and risk? And he replied, he goes, again, second level thinking, he goes, listen, conviction's amazing if you have the skill and you are right. Okay. So So, because I obviously reference Warren Buffett and going, you know, this whole idea of diversification and all of that sort of stuff. But the key thing is you got to be right. You got to have the skill, and then you got to be right. And my takeaway was, look, if you've got the skills of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, go for it. Have, you know, take big bets and big conviction. But otherwise, be humble and recognize there's an uncertain future, and manage your risk.
But what about the skill in your own industry? For instance, if you were looking at asset managers and what asset managers to invest in, you would know pretty well who the guys are that you think are undervalued and the companies that you think are offering a good, will offer a superior return. Whereas on the other hand, you'd pretty much know from your own industry because you should be. If there's one thing you know, you should know your own industry. You should know who to avoid. I guess there you might have conviction, but when you are playing a sports bet, for instance, you might think that the Sharks are going to win, and you might have a lot of conviction that that's going to happen, but actually you don't know enough about the other side or the opponents to have the expertise that a guy like Marx would be suggesting you need.
Yeah, I don't know, Alec. I think, you know, you might know everything about both teams. You don't know how the ball's going to bounce. Okay. It could be a lucky bounce. Some guy kicks it, boom. And that's the same thing. So if you look at our top 10, only comprises about 26, 27% of the portfolio. Okay. We don't take big bets. And we don't feel like, you know, we've done okay without taking big bets because we want to play 5-day cricket. I'm going to stay at the crease for a long time. I don't want to play IPL cricket where I'm slugging or we're taking massive bets, and because that's how you get bowled, and we don't want to get bowled. So, you know, so we'll rather smaller positions. We have the luxury of investing globally. So there's lots of choice. So that's what works for us. But I mean, everybody, you know, we just learned up here. I've been in this game long enough. Stuff comes out of nowhere. The ball bounces like you didn't think it was going to bounce.
Have you read much of Jordan Peterson's work?
Yes, I have. Yeah,
Order and Chaos. That's something that I'm also kind of rediscovering. The difference between order and chaos. It sounds to me like with investing, you should have a heck of a lot more order than chaos. In other words, be pretty sure that you don't lose money. Whereas in chaos, you could make a huge return, but you could lose it all as well. And in investing, that's not the game you want to play.
Totally, totally right. You know, and look, you don't know what Trump's going to tweet. We don't know what the ECB is going to do. We don't know what's going to happen with Putin. You know, there's lots of stuff you just don't know. He did get questioned about the current administration in the US. And he was obviously cautious about how he spoke about that. He said, look, if you think about the probability of an event and you've got a sort of normal distribution curve, okay? He said, right at the end of you've got that normal distribution curve, you've got those things called fat tails, okay? And the risk is those are tails. The risk is, so Nassim Taleb, and he actually quoted Nassim Taleb, fooled by randomness in the discussion, you know, where something comes left field, okay? Everyone's focused on the ball going down the back line, and then the scrum half picks it up and scores on, you know, something comes out of left of field. He goes, unfortunately, with this administration, there's an increased likelihood of that happening. So those tails are a bit wider. Okay. But that can be good and bad. You know, there's risk of tariff chaos, but at the same time, I guess there's the risk of the potential benefit of the war ending or whatever. Okay. So there's good and bad, but there are new things in the fat tails, you know, things like the administration not paying attention or adhering to a Supreme Court judgment. You know, that's a new thing that would never ever considered possible in the realms of probability in that. So that was his thing, which I guess comes back to the thing is more risk. You know, you just look at, I was just thinking this morning ahead of our conversation, you know, a few months ago, we were going to cut costs and it was going to be more efficient. Now Doge, you know, Elon's left Doge. They're not going to save $2 trillion. Elon was a big fan. Now Elon's saying it's calling Trump stuff an abomination. You know, the war was going to end, but now it hasn't ended, and sounds like he's letting Putin have a go at retaliating. So things work out so differently. You know, it's amazing how that all pans out. So
apply your thought process to what happened in the White House or in the Oval Office between Ramaphosa and Co. and Donald Trump. We've had, well, all kinds of people have come from all different areas on what the impact of that was, whether it was good or bad. Did you, as a South African who's based in the UK, would have been pretty interested in all of that, I guess, if not from an investment perspective, then just at least from a patriotic perspective?
Yeah, look, I was very disappointed in, and I always got to be careful about politics and that, but I just thought really, you know, really Trump, is that we're going to ambush somebody else now? The last one didn't go well. You think this one's going to go well? And I think it was very disappointing for the country. Clearly, crime is an issue. I thought the people who came out of that quite well. I thought Johan Rupert spoke very well. I thought John Steenhuisen spoke well. And it was, yes, we've got a massive problem with crime. And it's like, please, can you help us? You know, but this is all, it was premeditated. I think you came out badly. I think Trump came out badly. You know, I think Trump came out badly. So we all know we got a problem. There's not white genocide. It was disappointing. It was disappointing, but it showed Trump's colors again. So, you know.
Yeah, he's being even his greatest supporters are having pause at the moment.
Mm. Well, I think so. You know, he's not following through. I mean, you saw this taco, you know, Trump always chickens out. Yeah, having a good chuckle.
Oh, he didn't like that. Hey?
Oh, he did not like that. No, loves to call other people names, Sleepy Joe and all this other stuff. Okay, as soon as he gets called names, not happy. You know, that's not a good sign, is it? So, you know, forget about Trump, just anybody. Got to be able to laugh at yourself. So, you know, so Alec, just coming back to Howard, his recollection of his previous memos is incredible. He would constantly cite them. Oh, I wrote that memo in Jan 2014. Wow. I mean, I can remember I wrote a LinkedIn piece. I can't remember the month. So he hasn't been to South Africa. I've got some ideas I'm working on. It'd be fabulous to get in there. Let's see. But please, for your listeners who haven't, viewers who haven't read his memos or whatever, go and listen to them, find the podcast. And also that's the other thing. So on Oak Tree, you can sign up to receive his memos. And, you know, full marks to them. They said, if you sign up to receive the memos, don't worry. We are not going to send you every fun fact sheet and a whole lot of marketing material and all the rest now that we've got your address. If that's what you want the memos, that's all you're going to get. So, you know, it was a very, very positive experience. And hopefully some of your viewers get to experience it. You learn from that.
Members of the tribe, for sure.
Right? Members of the tribe.
They would like that, and particularly the point that you've made now, that again, he's a bit of a purist like you are, from the perspective of, we're not going to give this to a marketing department who are going to bomb you with information. Send, if you want this, you'll get only this, and we respect you. And I think that's really where it all boils down to. Sean, he didn't recommend any insights that we can apply that people who are watching this conversation or listening to this conversation would be able to say, Howard Marks says, buy Anglo-American.
No, I mean, key takeaway, think about your risk. Think about who you are and what you want to do. Don't run from bus stop to bus stop. Think about how much, especially now the markets, you know, I mean, Europe's up 18% this year. You know, the States is basically flat or up 1%. There's a lot going on. If you look at the CNN Feed and Greed and Fear Index, which is, there's a whole lot of metrics, you know, we're in greed. So think about how much volatility you can cope with and what your interest portion is on your portfolio. So I think those are probably the key takeaways. But he's got lots of good stuff on risk to think about. And he's a very sensible guy. And it was just such a pleasure to down to earth, wander around shaking everybody's hand going, I'm Howard. Is that who you are? You know, so wonderful. Yeah, I was really, very privileged. Thanks, Alec. And thanks to BizNews for giving me the platform that actually led to the whole thing.
Well, Sean, you know, that's all we do, is we just expose your incredible skills and intellect and knowledge and wisdom to our community. And it's up to you to either be the wise man or the fool. And we know where you are. Congratulations again on what you've achieved. Magnus said the other day, I don't know if you picked it up, but he said, damn it, I shouldn't have done anything except just given all the money to Sean. And then I'd be caning Pitfall Yun at the moment. But anyway, he has at least allocated some of his portfolio in that Million Rand Challenge. I'm not sure where it stands, but I think last I saw, Magnus was still trailing Pit. And hopefully you're going to be able to, from his perspective, ensure that that gap is really narrowed.
Yeah.
Super. Thanks, Alec. All right. Good lovely to speak to you.
And you. And Sean Pesh is the founder of Ranmore. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.